ago. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Emily Gresham Beamer. Coming up Thursday morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with Joanne Hardesty. At 9, Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Fight the Empire digs into the Mueller report. At 10, it's Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers with host Ken Jones, he talks with Paul Skenazy, author of the new novel Temper, California. And at 11:30 on The Film Show, they celebrate the glory days of weird amateur television. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by member support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
ExposeFacts.org is sponsoring a West Coast tour of political whistleblowers. The tour is in Corvallis on Thursday night, where former drone pilot Sean Westmoreland speaks at 7 p.m. at the Westminster House at the corner of Northwest 23rd and Monroe. On Saturday, the whistleblower tour arrives at the Augustana Lutheran Church, where Westmoreland speaks starting at 2 p.m. KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with journalist and author Norman Solomon about the issue and the events.
Sean Westmoreland is one of the great whistleblowers, really, of our era. He was a drone technician for the U.S. Air Force stationed in Afghanistan. And really, conscience got the better of him, or you might say he got in touch with his conscience and became one of the very few whistleblowers in the entire U.S. military drone program to speak out. And fortunately, he is now on a tour of Oregon and will be speaking in Portland as part of that tour.
All right. And at the end of this interview, I'm going to ask you for some of the dates and times. I know that tomorrow night he will be at Corvallis. But Norman, is there anyone else on the tour? And what is the goal?
Well, the goal, really, he's traveling solo, and his goal is to inform people about realities that really rarely get through the U.S. mass media, and that is the very compartmentalized and alienated and ultimately deadly facets of the U.S. military drone program. There's been a tremendous increase in the frequency of what are called drone strikes. Often, contrary to myth, they kill and injure people who are not the intended targets. And, of course, all this hinges on the so-called intelligence that would gather information about who who they are. And so it's many layers of moral and ethical huge problems with the drone program.
We often think of government and people who control drones, the military, we often think of them as a monolithic wall. And we'll even say they're doing this. And yet it's not like that. There's individual human beings within these institutions that choose to speak out. What is it, Norman, that motivates someone to become a whistleblower, do you think?
There's so many different layers and dynamics. In many ways, whistleblowers, at least ones I've met in this so-called national security realm, from the NSA, the CIA, Justice Department, and the drone program, they have a common aspect in that ultimately these are very individual, personal, intimate decisions. And for lack of a better word, it's about conscience. It's about deciding that safety and conformity are less important than being able to live with themselves, so to speak, and that has made a big difference. It was true of the Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg. It's certainly true of Sean Westmoreland.
Now, a few minutes ago, you had said he's one of the great whistleblowers of our time. Name some of the others, because then I want to start asking you about the political trends that make this so important. But who are some of the other important whistleblowers of our time?
Brandon Bryant is a name that many people would not know. He also, and he actually was the first U.S. Air Force drone whistleblower to speak out. Tremendous harassment as a result. Catherine Gunn, who leaked a memo about U.S.-UK surveillance of the U.N. Security Council in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. She is a largely unheralded whistleblower, although a film called Official Secrets, starring Keira Knightley, will be released in August, and she will no longer be so unknown. But her act of courage, which risked years in prison, occurred 15 years ago and more in Britain. This happens. People lose their jobs. They lose usually their work-based friends. They're tremendously vulnerable. Some of them go to prison. Someone who did is Jeffrey Sterling, the CIA whistleblower who I've gotten to know and visited in prison. He's now been released 2.5 years in a federal penitentiary, really for being a whistleblower about a CIA misbegotten and dangerous operation towards Iran called Operation Merlin. John Kerouac, a CIA whistleblower who spoke up about torture, and he also spent more than 2 years in prison. These are people who should be much more widely known, and it's really up to media outlets such as KABU to inform the public, because whistleblowing is something that is a powerful dynamic. And when you really think about it, there are many people listening to us right now who work in institutions that require, that cry out for whistleblowing, and that whistleblowing that is needed rarely happens for the usual reasons that it rarely happens, because people are afraid and they keep their head down. They know something wrong is happening, but it just is seen too hazardous to actually speak up.
It's an interesting issue when we look at whistleblowers, because it's a kind of activism that's around information.
The cliche is really true that information is power. If you talk to Daniel Ellsberg, he will tell you that he hoped that the Pentagon Papers would hasten the end of the Vietnam War. He's not convinced that they did, although the chain of events actually led to Watergate and the dangling threat of impeachment that forced Richard Nixon's resignation as president. Overall, without information, we have the uninformed consent of the governed, which is no consent at all. When you think about it, unless there's informed consent, then we're in the dark. We're fed what mushrooms are fed in the dark. It just is not democracy when we don't know what's being done in our names with our tax dollars by people who have been elected. And I think that is one of the crucial issues. That's why media issues blend in so much here. It's about whistleblowing, and it's also about journalism being independent, assertive, and brave. If you don't have media outlets, such as in the case of Edward Snowden, of course, a great whistleblower, an outlet willing to publish that material, as was the case with the Guardian newspaper in Great Britain, then also there's a choke-off of information. And that's where we need media outlets that are willing and able, hopefully have the resources and certainly have the willingness and courage to do that kind of work and to get material that is, if you will, purloined, some would say stolen. But that's what was said about the Pentagon Papers. That's what was said about the great whistleblower Chelsea Manning, who, as part of the repressive reality that we're in, is back in prison for refusing to testify at a draconian hearing of the grand jury. This is the atmosphere that we live in, and it's all the more important then, it's an unsolicited plug, for people to support the independent outlets like KABU, because frankly, so much of the airwaves are just buried in money machines. The airwave signals, the frequencies are just viewed from the top as ways to rake in maximized profits. And likewise, print outlets, the daily newspapers, and you know, the Oregonian is probably on average not particularly better or worse than other daily papers around the country. They're conformist. They don't challenge the power structure. Who is ripping off communities? How the real estate is being manipulated by those who already have millions and millions of dollars. These aren't abstract issues at all. When people would walk down the street in any city in this country, what they're seeing and what they're not seeing is very much affected by media coverage, and that media coverage is only going to improve if people are willing to speak out and share information that has been secreted away and kept away from public purview. And also, we need a press that's independent, and frankly, the huge mass media, they're not. One way we can look at whistleblowers is people who pass the baton to journalists. And one of the disturbing things to me is that when journalists get the credit that they do deserve for crossing the finish line with major stories, maybe they were stories that resulted from whistleblowers stepping forward and taking risks, huge risks, like Edward Snowden and Chelsea Manning, it is the journalists who are acclaimed for those stories. But they were passed the baton by the whistleblowers. And not only do whistleblowers rarely get the support and praise that they deserve, but often they are vilified, they are trashed, they are denounced, and their very freedom is threatened by imprisonment. And this is a huge gap. It's time for journalists to get real about that they're part of a team, and journalism should be embracing, and reporters should be supporting whistleblowers instead of, as Daniel Ellsberg has said, media institutions treating whistleblowers as snitches. Whistleblowers are essential to the democratic process and a real free press.
Just to follow up on that, I mean, would you say that President Barack Obama actually created this trend of incarcerating journalists and whistleblowers more than previous presidents? I just have to ask you that.
Barack Obama did more to damage whistleblowing in this country than any other president in our history, and that's actually statistical. He, under 8 years of the Obama administration, caused the prosecution of more whistleblowers than all other administrations combined. And that says a lot. It was 8 or 9, depending on how you count, were prosecuted. Several went to prison under the Obama administration and opened the door for the kind of persecution of journalists that is now, and whistleblowers, that has been now accelerating under the Trump administration. The fact is that Chelsea Manning was a whistleblower, and Julian Assange was a publisher, an editor, a journalist. And when I talked with Daniel Ellsberg, he's told me sometimes journalists will say, well, Mr. Ellsberg, you're like Julian Assange, he's a whistleblower. And Dan Ellsberg will correct them and say, no, it's Chelsea Manning who did what I did. He provided information that was classified to the public via a journalist. WikiLeaks is like the New York Times. It published information. And the threat of prosecution that is now underway toward Julian Assange should be causing media outlets and journalists to be outraged around the country. And the chances that the Oregonian, for instance, or the New York Times will crusade for the freedom of Julian Assange, those chances are not really great. And the failure of those media institutions to develop campaigns to free Julian Assange, those failures tell us just how ethically, journalistically bankrupt these huge media institutions are.
Norman Solomon, Institute for Public Accuracy, exposefacts.org, West Coast Whistleblower Tour. I have to tell you, Oregon loves you, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, well, thank you, and thanks to everybody at KABU for carrying the lantern high.
For KABU News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Today, we're airing part two of my interview with filmmaker Josh Tucker about the proposed pebble mine in southwest Alaska in his documentary, We Can't Eat Gold. I'm Emily Gresham Beamer for KABU News. The largest open-pit gold mine in the world has been proposed in the Bristol Bay watershed of southeast Alaska, which also happens to have the largest sockeye salmon run in the world. The Army Corps of Engineers is accepting public comments on the project until May 30th. Today, I'm speaking with filmmaker Josh Tucker about the realities of the proposed pebble mine and the fierce community resistance that has followed the proposal. Josh directed the 2013 documentary, We Can't Eat Gold, which chronicles the resistance of Alaska's native communities to the pebble mine. Could you speak a little bit more about how the Trump administration's appointments in the EPA created an environment in which this mine was able to move forward?
Right. So where we picked up the federal permitting process story before was 2014, where the EPA issued their proposed determination under 404C, blocking the mine from entering the permitting process. So the Pebble Limited Partnership sued, and that lawsuit was unresolved until Donald Trump's first EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, took office. Scott Pruitt, in May, so shortly after actually taking office, went ahead and met with Tom Collier in a meeting that was arranged by lobbyists and resolved the lawsuit and said he was completely blocking or withdrawing the proposed determination under 404C. The mine then entered the permitting process. So he let them into the permitting process. And that's when the Army Corps of Engineers process began. Now, this is at the same time that the Army Corps of Engineers was very quickly conducting the permitting process for the Dakota Access Pipeline. And so many folks who have followed the struggle in Standing Rock saw how quickly the Trump administration managed to get permits for that. And so what we're seeing with the Army Corps process for the proposed pebble mine is very analogous. Because if you look at their previous processes, like the Rosemont mine, that took 8 years to do their environmental impact statement, right? Or the Donlin mine in Alaska. These are other hard rock open pit mines. So Donlin took 6 years. Now the Army Corps, with this same speed that they had with Standing Rock, is looking to complete the environmental impact statement process in under 2 years for the proposed pebble mine. So we can see that not only did Administrator Pruitt jump on it as soon as he got in office, but then, just like they did with Standing Rock, the process, the permitting process, got drastically accelerated. So then there was some pushback and there was some national press coverage, and put out a sort of confusing statement saying, in echoing some of opponents of the mine's own language, saying, oh, well, you know, I'm going to go ahead and not withdraw the proposed determination. But then, right before, like a week before he actually had to resign, a memo to the Office of Management and Budget, which is part of the executive branch that controls proposed regulatory changes. And so this memo that is sort of Administrator Pruitt's final word on the proposed pebble mine was a memo to draft regulation to remove 404C authority under the Clean Water Act entirely. So not only would it retroactively invalidate this 2 years of science by dozens of people producing a 100-page study that is the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment, it would say that the EPA could not do that in the future for any other major project. And now the new EPA administrator has had to recuse himself from Pebble entirely because it was his law firm that set up the meeting between Collier and Pruitt when the Trump administration first took office. So we can see that it's a tangled web, and the Trump administration is, I believe, objectively conducting a madcap dash to ram permits through for what the Obama administration was quite clear about was an incredibly dangerous idea.
So the permitting process, is it completely controlled by federal agencies, or do some state agencies have a say in the end?
So there are state-level permits, and that's why Dunleavy's new appointee to the Department of Environmental Control, the former Anglo-American supporter of Pebble Mine, this guy actually tweeted that it was like Christmas came early when Pebble entered the Army Corps permitting process. So, you know, there's the federal NEPA process, right? And we can see that that's moving along at least three times as fast as comparable projects have, even smaller projects have. And then there's the state where miners were able to block a ballot measure by outspending it 14-1, put a lot of money into the Dunleavy campaign, elect somebody who is not only supportive of mining, but has a whole big family full of folks who are supportive of mining, who appoints people to the positions that make the decisions on state permitting that have said publicly that they're in support of this because they've worked on the Pebble Mine. Not dissimilar to Standing Rock or other projects people have faced, we've seen that the major development corporations have been able to grease the wheels and perform what's called regulatory capture, where the agencies that are supposed to be regulating an industry are indeed captured by that industry. And that is what's going on with the proposed Pebble Mine in Alaska. Mining companies, oil companies have always tried to play this game. They've just found the most receptive regulatory environment to do it in under the Trump administration, but they've always tried.
I think some people would argue that state capture has also occurred under the Trump administration, but that's another conversation. So the site of the proposed Pebble Mine has a history of seismic activity. Why is this important to consider?
So we talked about an open pit mine having a pit, like in the case of the proposed Pebble Mine, a pit 2 miles by 3 miles and over a mile deep into the Earth's crust. So they extract all the rock, and then they process it, and you end up with this huge lake next to it, which is much bigger. It could be like 9 miles by 3 miles, where all this wastewater with heavy minerals is. And that could be the arsenic that they use to extract the minerals. So we're talking about really toxic stuff. And so this big lake, which they call a tailings pond, of toxic material, right between the drainages of the most productive salmon spawning streams in the world. And well, how do they contain this lake? Well, yes, there is seepage and there is evaporation, but they contain it with a large dam. The dam could be hundreds of feet tall, and unfortunately, these tailings pond dams have a history of failing. So we've had over 50 tailings pond dam major failures in the last 10 years internationally. A lot of folks heard about the one in Brazil where almost 200 people were killed earlier this year. Colorado last year turned a river bright yellow. Interestingly enough, the same firm that the Pebble Partnership has proposed to the Army Corps of Engineers designed the one for the Mount Polley mine in British Columbia, which failed and created what many have called the largest mining disaster in Canadian history, where the toxic tailings from that tailings pond flowed into the Fraser River and did incredible damage to the habitat in that ecosystem. So already a tailings dam is a dangerous thing. What makes it a lot more complicated in the case of the Pebble Limited Partnership's proposed site is that there's a lot of fault lines there. There's the Lake Clark Fault, which is mapped to within a few miles of the mine. And then right when it gets to the mine site, there's a period where there's a little bit of academic debate, shall we say, about where the fault goes next. Now, the Pebble Limited Partnership says, it splits. It goes in two directions, one 18 miles to one side, you know, and way on the other side. Now, there's USGS data that contradicts this. There's a variety of data. There's some data that suggests it goes within 5 miles through the site. There's some data that suggests that the richness of the deposit was created by the fault, that those two plates rubbing against each other and the magma that welled up, that's what created the deposit, that they want to mine a fault line.
Huh.
They won't acknowledge that, and the interesting thing, and, you know, as folks think about if they want to submit a public comment before May 30th to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers, this is the last chance. May 30th, between now and May 30th, you can submit a comment to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. This is the last time anybody can be heard on this during the federal permitting process. Think about this, because even without the possibility of an earthquake, the tailings pond dam would have a 1 in 5 chance of failing within 100 years.
And this is because of structural factors?
As a structural thing, yep. And so the Army Corps of Engineers environmental impact statements, which they have rushed through, does not consider the possibility of a tailings pond dam failure at all. And it also does not consider the possibility that there could be an earthquake. This is an incredibly active seismic area. You know, less than 200 miles away in Anchorage in November, there was a 7.0 magnitude earthquake on a previously unknown fault line. Knocked the city out of power, broke the roads. It's a serious earthquake. There's a great website called groundtruthtrekking.org where a geologist named Hig Higman has been doing a lot of great research on the ground in Bristol Bay, collecting new data, has explained quite clearly that this is like playing with dynamite, putting a tailings pond dam there. Whether it's within 18 miles of a fault or within 5 miles of a fault or right on top of a fault, it dramatically increases that 1 in 5 chance that the tailings pond dam will break, just like the previous one that Knight Piskold, the firm that they have designing this one, did, and spill all this stuff. And the crazy thing is that this dam doesn't have to work for 20 years or 100 years. It has to work in perpetuity or forever, because there is actually no precedent for the kind of water reclamation that would have to be done to clean this water.
It would be the largest open pit gold mine in the world. So that's why there's no precedence, right?
Right. If you look at how many billion gallons of water, like we were talking before about some parallels, like Rosemont, they'll process 2 or 3 billion gallons of water a year. Pebble would have to process 7 billion gallons. And 11 million during the reclamation phase, according to their own numbers. So we're not only saying that this is bigger than, we're saying this is several times bigger than anything that's ever been tried before. And with water that gives life to culture and salmon that we can't get back.
And all nestled on a fault line.
All nestled on a fault line, yeah.
Wow. So you mentioned the public comment period is going to last until May 30th, and this is the last time people will be able to have official input on this mine. Are there other ways that you'd like to see people stand up against this mine?
Well, you know, for me, when I think about the little boats that I spent a lot of time in Bristol Bay with elders who aren't with us anymore, I want people to hear the voices of Bobby Andrew and Terry Hefferly, elders who are in We Can't Eat Gold, that have passed away since, and who started this fight with the mining company, have sort of passed it to the next generation to finish it. So I think that having their voices heard and having those voices to inform people's comments is really powerful.
Where can you find your documentary again?
It's at wecanteatgold.net or on Facebook if you search for We Can't Eat Gold. So if you just put We Can't Eat Gold in the internet, you'll get there. Getting informed about this process and writing an individualized public comment is perhaps the strongest step you can do from your own living room. And so there are links on We Can't Eat Gold's website right at the top to where you can submit your own personalized comment directly to the Army Corps of Engineers. Now, I know a lot of folks are busy, and writing a position paper on this might be a little challenging. So what I also want to say is that there's a lot of organizations out there that are collecting generic comments, where you can go to their website, like savebristolbay.org, and click Take Action. And they have a pre-written comment that you can just put your name on and file in 2 clicks, like an online petition. And that's something that can literally be accomplished in under a minute, when the permits will likely be issued, if Standing Rock is any guide. But then they will be challenged in court. And when they are challenged in court, these public comments will become a part of the court record. The fact that over 1 million people have commented in past public comment periods, but so far in this public comment period, only 5,000 people have filed a comment, I think highlights how important it is for folks who have an opinion on Pebble Mine to share it with the Army Corps of Engineers through even these generic comments that you can just click and send to your friends.
And these comments, they can be made by anyone. You don't have to be an Alaskan state resident.
Anybody in the world.
Anybody. That's good to know. Well, thanks so much for speaking with me, Josh.
Right on.
For KBOO News, I'm Emily Gresham Beamer.
It is 5:59 p.m., and next up is the KBOO Youth Collective. And now we're going to play some promos.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 37th Annual Oregon Ceramic Showcase, Friday, April 26th through Sunday, April 28th at the Oregon Convention Center in Portland. Oregon Potters Association's 37th Annual Ceramic Showcase and Sale features work by over 150 Oregon Potters Association members. It is one of the largest all-ceramic artist shows in the country, and the showcase features sculptures, wall art, jewelry, tiles, functional pottery, and more. Again, that's the Oregon Ceramic Showcase, Friday, April 26th through Sunday, April 28th at the Oregon Convention Center, 777 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 8th Annual Healing and Healthcare Blues Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 27th from 5 to 11 p.m. at North Portland Eagles Lodge in Portland. The 8th Annual Inner City Blues Festival is a benefit for healthcare for all Oregon and features performances by the Norman Sylvester Review, the Richard Arnold Trio, the LaRonda Steele Band, and many more. KBOO will be broadcasting the festival on air. Again, that's the 8th Annual Inner City Blues Festival on Saturday, April 27th from 5 to 11 p.m. at the North Portland Eagles Lodge, 7611 North Exeter Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm